online at wisegrain.org, which I really recommend as a great resource for material in this area which we'll hear about today. And also you'll see at the back some copies of Butcher's Grain, which is the brand new book. It's not actually available yet in the UK. It comes out on the 1st of December. So we're very pleased that if you'd like to become an advanced copy, they're available for sale during the breaks for £12 at the back. And without further ado, I'll hand over to Rick, who will introduce you today. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you, Rohan. Can you hear me all right in the back? There's no sound amplification, and the room has funny acoustics. So how's it going in the back there at this tone? Okay. My voice tends to soften, particularly as I go along sometimes, and so if you can't quite hear me, start waving your arms in the back there. Second, I'm sitting on a Zafu, so I can see you better and you can see me. There actually is a room in this room to move around some, and so what might work actually is if you feel too jammed up in the front, to kind of move back, which then will allow more capacity to see me. Okay, and I should also use that as a way of saying please be comfortable here, move around. I will have a break in the morning and then a break in the afternoon, and then we will take a lunch break, but if you want to get up, stretch your legs, use the bathrooms, or get some water, it's really okay. We will do a number of guided meditations, and so during those in particular, if you do need to get up, try to obviously do it, not disturb people. Also, to make the obvious announcement, which I usually forget, please turn off your cell phone if you already, unless you have already done that. So why don't I introduce myself very briefly, and let me say I feel very privileged, truly privileged, and truly honored to have this opportunity to be here with you today, to be welcomed into a setting and to be invited to actually present information for the better part of a day, and that the people would actually want to come, you know, on a Sunday to listen to is just great. And so I want to say I feel very welcome here, both by London Insight, which has been very gracious and supportive. One of my principal teachers is Christina Feldman, who's been a major influence for me, including in terms of the concentration practices and how to really think about them and why they're important that we'll be getting at today. And I recently met Stephen Batchelor, who was just marvelous to talk with. And so I just think it's great here. I'm friends with Gay Watson. Some of you may know her as well. In this community. And Chris Cullen has been a good friend of mine going all the way back to this meditation teacher training we did and survived, which ended some years ago. So I feel very pleased to be here and welcome you to doing this today. Let's see, my own background briefly is I'm a psychologist by training, a clinician. I started meditating in 1974. I've been through the culture wars in America, the human potential movement, many different kinds of training in psychology, ranging from very traditional psychoanalytic, psychodynamic training, as well as a big chunk of Jung, and then lots of cognitive behavioral, lots of humanistic psychology, some crazy cults and gurus along the way. And then, but always, I still recall that first experience I had of reading, the kind of the view that's embedded in the Eastern view of oneness and the inevitability of suffering that ensues when we grasp at fleeting pleasures and struggle with fleeting pains. That immediately convinced me of the truth of it. It took me a while to kind of actually try to sincerely embody that truth in a more continuous and lived way. That began more, I'd say, around 15 years ago. And also around that time, while I've always had a deep interest in the brain, because it's ground zero, it's really the crossroads, it's the bottom line for the mind, as I'll explain in a little bit later, I really began learning an awful lot about the brain starting around 15 years ago, and then particularly around 10 years ago, which matches the explosion of knowledge about our brain, the 3 pounds of tofu right between the ears, that's doing everything you're experiencing right now, more or less. I'll explain the less and the more in a minute. But it's amazing to think that what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're thinking, remembering, feeling, is massively produced by your own brain. I'll also get to the question of the mind-brain interface and the question of transcendental factors as well. But to kind of tip you where I'm going here, within the Western science view, certainly, the brain is the necessary and proximally sufficient condition for the mind. So it's just marvelous if you accept that framework, and you don't have to accept it at all. As the Buddha said a long time ago, see for yourself. See for yourself what seems true, and see for yourself what seems useful. That said, it's kind of within that frame amazing to me that what I'm seeing you and you're seeing me and we're listening and all the rest of that, that's just amazingly produced in ways that are as yet completely mysterious by this 3 pounds of gush inside the head, right? So, as I was saying, the knowledge about the gush has doubled in the last 20 years. We live in a time when the amount of knowledge, of scientific knowledge about the brain, has literally doubled in the last 20 years. It's really quite extraordinary. And also during the last 20 years, we've had this historically unprecedented intersection that Rohan was talking about, of Western science and the contemplative traditions. These two ancient traditions of knowledge and praxis, you know, practice that's informed by understanding and insight. And so their coming together has just been unprecedented, and I've been extremely interested in the intersection of those two things, have been very deeply engaged with it. On the one side, I was on the board at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which is a major American center. Jack Kornfield, Sylvia Borstein, people like that are centered there. It's sort of the sister center to IMS, which is the cousin of Gaia House, so it's like, you know, a consortium, if you will, a multinational Vipassana corporation. Not really, but sort of. And so the net of that is that I've had a very, I would say, strong Buddhist background, particularly the last 10 or 15 years, which is coincident with a neuroscience background. And in particular, out of all of that, when I'm especially interested in applications, which I think is consistent with the Buddha's view. I mean, the secondary matter, he said, was his propositions about the nature of reality. The primary matter was, as he said, he taught one thing, suffering and its end. The primary matter is what's efficacious, what's helpful, what's useful for this person in this place at this time. And so, for me, my own focus on neurodharma is applied. Applied neurodharma is the mouth-twisting phrase I use for what I think I'm trying to do. And so today we're going to mostly focus on the applied part and bring it home to what hopefully will be useful for you in terms of your practice, particularly in terms of a major theme of practice, which is steadying the mind. So that's what I hope to do with you all today. And I hope we do together today. Okay. So to kind of set this up, in a moment we'll do a guided practice. As with all the guided practices, feel free to ignore my suggestions entirely or adapt them to your own needs. Go at your own pace. I'll use a fairly standard instruction that the object of attention be the sensations of the breath. You're welcome to use a different object in particular. Some people get anxious when they bring awareness into the body, particularly if they've had any kind of trauma history. I want to really respect that form of neurological diversity, which is, sidebar, a topic we'll be getting into more. And, you know, feel very free to change the instruction. Look around the room, you know, get a sense of another person who maybe, you know, seems benign to you as an object of attention. Just whatever works for you. Okay? And then after doing that sort of practical experiential thing, I'll unpack what was happening, hopefully, inside your brain while you were doing 5 simple instructions that are foundational instructions that are neurologically informed. And then I'll use that as a segue to talk about the mind-brain system, get some kind of intellectual heavy lifting out of the way, so we can get down to, you know, work, if you will, in terms of the applied part. I'll do a quick tour of the amazing brain. It just never ceases to thrill me to actually talk about this, you know, gush between the ears, as it were. And then we'll move into a roadmap from the Buddha for deepening concentration and being able to steady the mind as a means to an end of liberating insight. It's an end in itself in terms of it feels good to steady the mind and to stabilize it, but it also is a means to the end of freedom from suffering, both progressively and completely. And then in the afternoon in particular, we'll do a number of practices. Come back after lunch. Really, that's when the real good stuff starts. And particularly a series of experiential meditations that, in my Western or American, I should say, baseball metaphor, I'd rather swing for the fences. I want to aim for a home run here. On the other hand, the people in American baseball who have the highest strikeout rate have the highest home run average. So it may strike out, but I hope not. But I'd rather swing for the fences. So I'm going to really go after here with you some fairly deep states of awareness that are not that are often not really achieved until day 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, whatever, on a retreat. Okay. That said, one of the pitfalls, of course, and one reason why concentration practices have not been emphasized very much in the West, and I'll talk until recently, and I'll talk a bit about that, is that the pitfall potentially is to get goal-directed. And so the art is to be somewhat intentional. Let's remember the second of the eight aspects of the Eightfold Path was wise intention. The Buddha really emphasized intention, the importance of intentionality. So there's a place for intentionality without craving, right? And that's the sweet spot that we want to explore here. And one nice thing about concentration practices is that they're a good vehicle for exploring that sweet spot, where one is, in a phrase that I'll use from the Buddha in some slides, where one is diligent, ardent, heartfelt, resolute, and mindful, right? Ardent, diligent, resolute, and mindful, while simultaneously not clinging to the outcome, right? Isn't that kind of a nice sweet spot in life, not just on the cushion? So we can explore some of that. And the nice thing about concentration practices, because they're very specific. You know when you're doing them, you know when you're on, you're off. Yeah, louder? Good, that was good feedback. Well, I may stand up, who knows, at some point, wander around. I get excited, I start standing up and waving my arms. Okay, I think it's clear. All right, so let's see if there's anything else here. Doot-da-doot. Oh, I should say this. I'm going to yak a fair amount. You don't need to take notes. We have a good handout. These talks will be posted on both the Linden Insight website as well as my own website, which Rohan mentioned, wisebrain.org. It's freely offered. I think of it as a basket of tools. A lot of resources there. Articles various people have written. A kind of greatest hits of public domain scientific papers in this area that are very relevant. Slideshows from previous workshops, things like that. So it's a good resource. The book itself, frankly, is, I think, also a very good resource. It's been very well reviewed and endorsed by people like Christina Feldman, Joseph Goldstein, as well as a number of academics. So that's another resource for you. Okay, let's see if I have anything I need to say. One little thing that goes back to what I was saying about goal-directedness. I personally think there are three great pillars of practice, which is to say, working with the mind, being with the mind, and transcending the mind, right? That kind of summarizes what we do. It's interesting, actually, that being with the mind, working with the mind, being with the mind, and transcending the mind loosely corresponds to three fundamental functions within the nervous system. In other words, working the nervous system operates, yours and mine, through regulating, through learning, and through selecting. Well, regulating sounds a lot like working with the mind, which kind of interestingly corresponds to the sila, or virtue, or morality, or restraint, pillar of practice traditionally, which I'll talk more about later. Interestingly also, the learning faculty of mind really corresponds to being with, because when we be with, we're really paying attention to something, and when we pay attention to something, that operates like a spotlight and vacuum cleaner that sucks what we're attending to into the neural tissues of our own brain. So that's interestingly a kind of correspondence, and selecting is really the wisdom factor in the brain, if you will. You know, we choose something better or we choose something worse. I think often what wisdom boils down to is giving up or letting go of or renouncing a lesser pleasure for a greater one. And you see that kind of languaging actually throughout the Dharma, where people progressively let go of baser pleasures, including meditative pleasures, for more sublime, more subtle, and in some sense higher attainments or states. And then you discover the clinging that's embedded in that one as well. You relax and release that and move to the next one and on. That's kind of a path of wisdom, isn't it? How that's built out in the brain or instantiated in the brain is through selecting. We select this way rather than that way. You know, we start heading down tunnels with cheese rather than tunnels with no cheese. Right? Okay. So isn't that interesting how those all go together? And in some sense, the ultimate wisdom, of course, is to transcend the contents of mind through some kind of fundamental sense of, often impossible to put into words, sense of or knowing of or insight into the fundamental nature of mind, which is particularly well described in the Mahayana tradition as always already spacious, empty, which is to say kind of interdependent, awake, and with an affectively positive quality of luminosity, compassion, and even bliss. And if one is spiritually inclined to something that's transcendental, and of the two great possibilities, either there is something transcendental or there isn't, you know, Buddhism has different views about that depending on where you are historically in it, as you probably know. You know, that transcendental aspect is the ultimate transcending, if you will, the ultimate refuge that some people turn to. So of the three, the point I'm trying to make here is that we'll be mostly doing working with. And I consider working with to be the least important of the three, because you can't always work with the contents of mind, but you can always be with them. And most profoundly, we can transcend them. That said, we're going to do the working with side. And sometimes that's frustrating. I'll be doing kind of a workout with you here. A lot of what my aim is just to offer a variety of neurologically informed tools to use, skillful means, and then have you just pick and choose among them what works for you. So some of them won't work for you. And, you know, if frustration comes up, that's okay. It's just another content of mind, right? Arising and passing away in the vast open space of mind, you know, like a shooting star. So that's a way to be with all that. Okay, please ask questions or offer comments along the way, although I will have some specific times for questions and discussion. I should add, too, that if you want to get the Wise Brain Bulletin, we put out this bulletin every month. It's kind of neat. The quality varies a little bit, but mostly it's pretty good, I think. You know, I take email lists with great respect. I don't share them with other people. And I think we'll put up a sign-up sheet at the back. If you'd like to get on my email list for the Wise Brain Bulletin, you can always unsubscribe. Okay. One more thing I'd like to say is that, as most of you know, probably, you paid a registration fee, right, of some kind to come here today. And the interesting thing about those registration fees, and it's true for London Insight, I suspect, much as it is for Spirit Rock and other centers, the reg fees you paid only cover part of the costs of what it takes to run London Insight, you know, to keep it going. And the rest of it is provided through donation, which is a larger example of something that's really neat and profound and true in the Buddhist tradition, and not only in it, which is that we're here in part because of the generosity of others. I'm certainly here in part because of the generosity of many, many beings, many people in, you know, in this lifetime, and as well as many beings along the long run from the Buddha's day, as well as he rested in the generosity of beings long before him in the great Hindu traditions. See how it is? We're carried by a stream of generosity. And in that light, you know, by offering generosity, which is one of the first things the Buddha typically taught when he moved to place, we help that stream continue, and we also gladden our heart. You know, it makes people happy to give, basically, particularly if they give a right amount. Actually, there have been some neurological studies that the pleasure centers in the brain light up more when people make a charitable donation. If you give subjects, typically college sophomores, the guinea pigs of most social science research, anyway, who desperately need academic credit and will do anything for it, or need $10 or £5, the equivalent. Anyway, if someone's given £5, and they can keep it or they can give it to charity, and you put them in the scanner and you see what happens as a result. If they give it to charity, they get more activation on average in the pleasure centers of the brain than if they keep it for themselves. It's a neural illustration of the pleasures of generosity. Anyway, generosity is also great practice because it cuts right into the grasping and contraction that's also at the heart of selfing, of being a self as a verb over time. It's taught again and again and again. It's a really important practice. So I'd like to say two things about that. One, there are many forms of generosity. Attention is a form of generosity. Sincerity, goodwill, presence. Your generosity here is going to help make this better for everyone else. Makes it better for me if no one came. How could I have this much fun, you know? For me, I couldn't do it. often we get reductionistic about generosity, especially in a Western culture, and monetize it. And there are many, many forms of generosity. Rohan's generosity, for example, volunteering. You know, London Insight is run by volunteers. To the best of my knowledge, there's no paid staff. So those are all forms of generosity. You may well yourself have given of your time to London Insight. Additionally, it could probably use some of your money. So if you're moved to contribute to London Insight, you know, over the days or years ahead, that would be a good thing. Right? Some people sometimes ask, how much should I give? I say, like other teachers do, just give what makes you happy. Whatever would make you happiest to give, do that. And often there's an intuition in the heart that speaks to that. Also myself, I'm here, no one's paying me to do this. I love the tradition in Buddhism, and in the range of views about it, I'm kind of a traditionalist in the sense that teachings are offered freely, not in a let's make a deal kind of way. So they're offered freely. Whatever you do, they're offered, right? For better or for worse. Hopefully for better. On the other side of it, if you're moved to make a donation to me in some monetary form or any other kind of form, I will very gratefully accept it and very appreciatively accept it. And they'll have some kind of basket out there for that purpose. And that's a great circle. You know, the classic example of that, you know, is the monk comes out with the bull. It's very simple. And they don't put it in anyone's face. They actually just kind of hang out. And people put food in it or they don't. They are sustained by what they're given and what they take in. And that itself is their practice. And it's the practice of people, the villagers, if you will, to put an offering in the bowl and, you know, to be happy and gladdened as a result, and also support the monastic community as an example of the teaching stream. So that's kind of how it works. And that's the end of this Dhana talk. Okay. All right, ready to roll? All right. So some disclaimers. This is on the frontiers of science. Obviously, as well, you know, I'm going to be offering information based on science. That's the good news. On the other hand, as Tenzin Palmo, an Englishwoman you may know, spent 12 years in a cave in Tibet, more or less, and another 12 or so on other kinds of retreat, has said here, you know, there's so much we don't know. We just... Science is right at the very beginning. I think neuroscience is roughly where biology was about 100 years after the invention of the microscope, which is to say around 1725. It's really, really, really early days. People routinely will ask me a question and, you know, about some finding or research on this or that, and I'll say, to the best of my knowledge, no. There might be somewhere, but I haven't come across it, and I have a pretty good sieve for stuff. And you know, these are really, really early days. So we want to not take this stuff too seriously. Another thing to say is that, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, people who knew nothing about the brain, you know, did things with their mind to produce other states of mind. They did practices, you know, think of it like this. They did practice A to produce mental state C. All right. Now, C is the target. Happiness, love, and wisdom broadly defined in, you know, helpfulness and non-harming to others. Increasingly, though, with Western science, we're starting to understand what's going on in the black box B for brain, right? We know that mental activity A produces brain state B, which leads to mental state C. C is what we're going after. What's the opportunity here is that as the dotted lines get clearer and clearer between mental activity A producing brain state B leading to mental state C that we care about, then we can start fiddling around inside the black box. But on the other hand, you know, knowing about the black box is not necessary, because for thousands of years, thousands, tens of thousands of people minimally have attained full awakening, in my own view, and millions more, a great deal of value along the path. Right? That said, the question is, you know, where does neuroscience add value? And I hope to explore, you know, that with you today. Okay. Yeah, so I said a lot of the rest of it. You know, I'm going to talk about psychology, neurology, and Buddhism. Some people are more interested in one or the other of those. Sometimes they get bored or restless when we're talking about a circle as a word that they're not interested in. It's okay. It's more content in the mind, passing through the mind like birds across the sky. On the other hand, there might be some interesting stuff that's kind of outside your own sweet spot. Just to introduce myself, my own background is more in the Theravadin, sometimes called Vipassana wing, although that's kind of a misnomer because Vipassana means insight. All Buddhist traditions have insight. You know, all contemplative traditions have insight. And you can have insight without being a contemplative as well. That said, I'm kind of trained in that wing. There's also Zen and Tibetan and Pure Land. And while I certainly respect those traditions, I'm going to speak more from the Theravadan wing, which actually has had a very interesting intersection with Western science, because the original teachings of the Buddhas, they've been preserved in the Pali Canon, Pali being the language of the earliest Buddhist written record of the teachings. When you get a good translation, and I want to give a shout out to Bhikkhu Bodhi, who I think has done an extraordinary job of translating while dealing with intense chronic pain. He's done beautiful translations, and they're very clear in the language. I find them very clear psychologically in terms of a Western sense, and they map quite well to underlying neurological activities as are being increasingly understood, that are the basis of different psychological states. So that canon that's associated with the Theravadan wing of Buddhism is actually really useful, because it doesn't have mystical features in it. It doesn't have the, to me, obscurantism of Zen sometimes. It doesn't have the shamanic interweaving that you find in Tibetan teachings. It's very bare. It's very experience near. Okay. All right. So let's do a practice. Okay? Any questions so far or comments? I'm getting warm in here myself. I don't know what the... Will we have air conditioning in here, Chris?
There is some, but it's quite noisy.
Oh, it may not be time yet. How are you doing with the temp? Right, great. Okay, we're okay with closing your eyes with this door open? I think the space is quiet, and I'll kind of be watchful. Okay, great. Great. Okay, so how about we do a practice? Yeah? So we're going to do a sitting. How many of you meditate at least once a month? Okay, great. Mostly experienced people. Just for those few who maybe don't have much practice with meditation, come on in, welcome. Let's see. Meditation is actually really simple for a few seconds. In other words, meditation basically is about being present. Being present. Being present with, you know, candle outside you, of candle flame, or being present with something in your own experience, such as the breath, or a mantra, a saying you're using in your mind. The tricky part is sustaining that presence after a few breaths in a row. That's where, for various reasons in evolution, the brain tends to want to move on to something else to make sure that there's no, you know, velociraptor out there trying to chomp the little mammal living in the bushes, you know, in Jurassic Park, right? And that's the trick. But we're going to try to really do some other tricks with the black box to extend the capacity of the brain, and therefore the mind, to stay with things longer. That's anyway the basic nature of meditation. So how about take a big breath and relax? You can leave your eyes open or closed. If they're open, you might want to just rest them on a spot, maybe 6-8 feet in front of you, 4-8 feet in front of you. If you close your eyes, it's really fine too. And start being aware, if you could, of your own body sitting here. In a few moments, I will offer 5 simple suggestions. Again, you're welcome to depart from them. And after the 5 suggestions, which will have about 30 to 60 seconds of silence in between them, I'll invite you to pay attention to each and every breath as best you can for 5 minutes straight. That's about 75 breaths. It's actually not that easy, especially in the beginning, to do that. If your mind wanders, it's fine. Just bring it back. When we do get to the point of paying attention to each breath, it may help you to count them. Perhaps from 1 to 10, starting over when you get to 10, or starting over if you lose track, or simply note them very, very gently in the back of your mind. In, out, rising, falling. Or you may find that even the subtlest use of language is distracting, and then don't use it. And I'll ring the chimes, the gong, when we're done. So the first suggestion, form an intention for this sitting. You might do it with words or non-verbally as a kind of image or sense in your body. You may also bring to mind a sense of being someone or channeling, in a sense, someone who embodies that intention. A teacher you know, perhaps an historical figure, maybe the Buddha himself. However you do it, set an intention and simultaneously observe what happens inside you in the process of pursuing each of these five suggestions. All right, second suggestion, and feel free to go at your own pace as well. Really relax. For example, relax your tongue, your jaw muscles. Focus on exhaling in particular, maybe exhaling longer than usual for a few breaths. With each exhalation, really let go. Sit erect in a way that promotes a posture in which you can really relax your body. Deliberately relax the muscles in your body, maybe in rhythm with each exhalation. Relax. All right, third suggestion. Bring to mind as much of a sense of safety as you can. In other words, explore and let go of any unnecessary anxiety, any unnecessary vigilance or guardedness. And as with all the suggestions, observe what happens in your mind as you do this. For example, bring to awareness a knowing of being in a relatively protected setting among good people, or a sense of your own capacities, your own strengths to deal with what life may bring. However you do it, see if you can explore helping yourself to have a growing sense of as much safety as you truly deserve here and now. And notice, of course, what happens in your mind as you do so. All right, fourth suggestion. Bring to mind or find already present some positive emotion, often subtle or mild, like a sense of gratitude. Or bring to mind someone you love, a pet, children, a mate, a friend, a teacher. Or see if there's some happiness or contentment or simply peacefulness. Not straining to make yourself feel happy, but inviting happiness in and inviting it to fill you. Maybe using a little bit of a half smile to help kindle it and welcome it. Smile to your body and let your body smile back to you. Letting yourself feel as good as possible, and of course observing what arises in the mind as you attempt to do this, including any interesting resistance to feeling really good. And the last suggestion, as you continue to help yourself truly feel as good as possible, intensifying those feelings as you can and filling your body with them, in the fifth suggestion, sense that the benefits of this meditation, whatever they happen to be, are actually sinking into you, like water into a sponge, soaking into you, weaving their way into your being. So that, in their own way, small or large, they can be with you from now on as you make your way in this life. And now, on the basis of those five suggestions and whatever value they may have had for you, let's pay attention to each breath from beginning to end. Staying present with the sensations of the inhalation, and then present with the sensations of the exhalation that follows. Sensations felt perhaps in the belly, the chest, maybe the throat, the cool air coming in, the warm air going out, perhaps around your upper lip. Each breath, a fresh breath, knowing in the Buddhist words, if you're breathing in or breathing out, or breathing long or breathing short. Each individual breath for the next 5 minutes. Come on back. I was just reflecting on how when I go to different places, I always need to calibrate the gongs or the bells. You know, some of them you just tap them, it clangs, and others you have to really whack. So I'm learning. How was that? What did you experience? Particularly the five suggestions, or following each breath as best you could. That's about 75 breaths in a row. That's no mean feat for 5 minutes straight. What did you experience? Anyone care to offer? Oh, one sec. Yeah, please. And speak up if you could for everyone. That way I won't have to repeat what people say.
I found the suggestions really helped me relax, and particularly the one about saying that you're in a safe place. I know I'm in a safe place, but actually my body was holding a bit of fear, and by that alleviated a lot of the fear and helped me really relax, and what fills up that space is really good energy and allows luck to flow. So it was really helpful.
That's right, isn't it? And that's you can generalize that insight right there. You know, that's a good one. Yeah, I'll say more about that. But you know, we evolved to be very vigilant and anxious creatures, and we usually have, you know, occasionally we don't have enough anxiety and vigilance, but usually we have unnecessary anxiety and vigilance, and that creates suffering in its own right, and also leads us to be reactive to others, and it makes it harder to bring attentional resources inward. Because the sentinels are out there on the battlements looking for invaders, right? And it's hard to also feel loving when, as you were saying, one feels subtly threatened. Or, you know, so it's a really important one. And one that many people have difficulty with. And some people feel anxious when they feel safer. Because given their history, experienced or observed, feeling safer and relaxing and lowering your guard, whap, that's when they really jump out of the bushes and nail you. So just kind of watch that process around feeling safer. But you're exactly right. That's an important step as best you can. It's no accident that the Buddha found his awakening, I think, with his back to the Bodhi tree. Because the tree had his back, right? And it forced everything to come at him, including Mara, either metaphorically or literally, the representation of delusion and trickery, the antithesis of insight and awakening. Anyway, it forced all that to come at him from the front. So I think there's no accident either that traditional instructions continually talk about finding a place of refuge, basically, where you're relatively safe among good people, both refuge in yourself and refuge in practical, reasonable terms in your environment. And on the basis of that, be able to really bring resources in to go deep. Okay, anybody else? Another person? Yeah, please. Oh, and then you too were going to say something. How about first you?
Being in bed as a child. And just hearing the wind outside and knowing I was safe in bed.
Great. And that's a wonderful method, you know, to activate that very strong felt memory, which then lit up all kinds of circuits, whatever. But the bottom line is that it helped you. That's wonderful. Okay, you?
I was just going to say, yes, as often I find it very really difficult to concentrate on 75 breaths.
Yes. Oh yeah, it's a swinging home run there. I don't know what the cricket term would be or something, but I saw on YouTube or something a fellow who did a rugby kick and hit the crossbar. That was in some kind of news recently here in England, and so it can be at that level of difficulty to really track 75 in a row. All right, but by the end of today, I think you actually might find yourself being able to do that. I hope at least some of you. Okay, anybody else? What did you experience? Yeah, please. Speak up, please. If you.
I felt the initial stuff you did, the suggestions were really relaxing.
Yeah.
But then at the end, when I was focusing more on just my breath, I felt quite a lot of fear was coming up that seemed to be just sort of held in my lungs.
Yes.
I just wondered if you could.
Yeah. Yeah, so her comment, correct me if I don't get it completely right, was that the initial suggestions were helpful in terms of relaxing, and I suspect, along with relaxation, because we can relax and just go zoning out, but the trick, you know, is that sweet spot where we're both relaxed, but attention is steady and acute, You know, it's penetrating. So with that, I'm imagining that was there. But then when she put her attention into the breath and the body, she noticed that it was as if there was a kind of embedded or implicit anxiety or fear held in the lungs, seemingly, or sensed in the breathing area, which then became more prominent when she put her attention so steadfastly into the breath, right? And then what is that and what to do about that? It's a very natural thing. Very often what happens when we kind of calm the mind, you know, when the sediments of the pond of the mind, if you will, start to settle out and the pond gets clear, you start seeing some of the sludge or the dragons down there, you know, in the rocks at the bottom of the pond. And a lot of us do have anxiety or fear held in the body through life experiences, either, again, directly experienced or simply observed. And also there's a normal distribution, a normal range of temperament. People are born with some natural disposition, or they're actually conceived, you know, because when the DNA comes together, that's when temperamental tendencies are established genetically. And then, of course, life experiences and the environment go to work, as well as our own internal activities. So people vary in their dispositional tendencies around anxiety altogether. And sometimes what happens, as I said, is that you access those feelings. And then the trick, of course, is to help yourself regard them as another content of mind, you know, and as is skillful for you in that moment, be with them. Minimally, you are being with them. I could see that already. And then in terms of working with them, I'll talk a little bit later on maybe of some different methods for working with them. I actually do a whole workshop. I taught it with Christina in America on equanimity, which is, I think, one of the real unsung heroes of Buddhism. It doesn't get a lot of glamour. Equanimity, you're like, huh? You know, it's boring. No way. But it's really, really fundamental in how to develop greater equanimity. I think a simple thing is to keep reminding oneself of the truth. The truth is that you are relatively safe. You know, the truth is that your capacities today to deal with life are almost certainly so much greater than they were when you were young and when most of that fear, if you will, you know, developed. And also you can get away from things much better. We have a lot more possibilities for escape from threats as adults usually than we did as kids, because we were stuck with our older brother, right? Or the kids in school, or our parents, or our stepfather, or our mom's boyfriend, okay? Or our mother herself.